Welcome to Eastern Standard, a broadcast service of Eastern Kentucky University, produced with the support of One, the All-Tech Ideas Conference, and Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin, and in this hour, Jerry Roll of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky.
We are a foundation that is based in Eastern Kentucky, for Eastern Kentucky. We're with Eastern Kentucky.
Laura Smith of the Appalachian Impact Fund.
We are the first and only place-based impact investment fund focused on Eastern Kentucky.
Annie Rouse on the growing pains of a burgeoning new Kentucky hemp industry.
There's still a lot we don't know about cannabinoids and how they're interacting with certain medications and things in that regard that really need to be more fully vetted.
And Kentucky maple syrup.
What if we did it today as an economic piece, as an economic driver?
First this hour, the Ohio River is a drinking water source for about 5 million people. It's also a heavily industrialized river. The federal government has been rolling back protections from pollution generated by industries along the Ohio. But recently, a commission that represents Kentucky and seven other states along the river and its nine tributaries voted to maintain its authority to set regional water pollution standards rather than giving up that power to each individual state. James Bruggers has been following this story, and after more than 18 years covering energy and the environment for the Courier-Journal, Jim is now a writer for Inside Climate News, and he joins us from member station WFPL in Louisville. Greetings, Jim.
Why, thank you. Good to be here.
And if you would first bring us up to speed, what was the proposal before the Ohio River Valley Water Sanitation Commission, or SANCO, as we're going to refer to it going forward?
The proposal that's before them now is pretty similar to what the current situation is, with maybe a little caveat. Our SANCO, this commission, would retain the authority to be able to establish water quality standards for this 981-mile-long river and the industries along it. But it would give states the ability to, if they don't want to follow them, to propose something that's an alternative, and then that alternative would be reviewed in the course of whenever the states would be issuing permits for the industries. And then Orsenko would look at those permits and see whether they were generally consistent with what Orsenko standards are and whether they would make sure that the river would maintain its designated uses, such as recreation, swimming, fishing, drinking water, that sort of thing.
So this commission has a pretty long history of setting water standards for hazardous chemicals and heavy metals from coal burning and other industries, often at tougher levels than state or federal standards. Do these standards, these Orsenko standards, have teeth? Are they enforceable?
Orsenko itself doesn't have an enforcement arm, but the states do. And the states are members of a compact. And for those states that have adopted the Orsenko standards, and not all of them have, which is something that I guess has come out through this process, a recognition that not all the states are following all the different water quality standards, and there's many of them. But it's the states that actually do the enforcement. So what you have with Orsenko and a regional commission like this is you've got an agency or a body that then gets all these states together to come up with kind of a shared vision of what water quality looks like. And then it's up to the states then to enforce that vision.
So let's talk about what's going into the river from industries along the Ohio's banks, along the banks of its tributaries. What kinds of pollutants can be found in the wastewater coming from these plants?
Well, there's sewage from sewage treatment plants. And, of course, a lot of that sewage most of the time is being treated, but there's still some residuals that can be in that can cause some potential harm. And then there's also industries. You know, there's still some steel industry. There's still a number of coal-fired power plants. And there's other manufacturing plants, and they can discharge heavy metals and other kinds of pollutants. In fact, it's really interesting. Sort of the granddaddy of all federal government pollution databases is the Toxics Release Inventory. And the EPA requires industries to self-report the pollution that they emit, either land, air, water. And the Ohio River in recent years, as recently as I think 2015, received the most industrial pollution than any other river in the country. So it is a significant working river at this point. Now, there's all kinds of other pollution. You know, there's a lot of stormwater runoff, and there's pollution from farms. And so other rivers could be more polluted. But in terms of industrial pollution, the Ohio River has long kind of carried a pretty significant burden.
Okay, getting back to the matter before the commission, before Arsenko, if you would describe the battle lines for us. Who has been rooting for the commission sticking to its guns and maintaining these standards, and who has been pressing to get rid of them?
The battle lines are pretty clearly drawn. It's the general public and drinking water utilities have not wanted Arsenko to give up its authority to set regional water quality standards, whereas the heavy industries, the electric utilities, they've generally wanted the Arsenko to, you know, no longer set those standards and focus more on research and monitoring water quality in the Ohio River. They argue that the Arsenko standards duplicate state standards, duplicate federal standards. Arsenko was created in like 1948, was well before the establishment of the EPA in 1970 and before the passage of the Clean Water Act in 72. So there are, in the Clean Water Act, the EPA does have guidance for how states are supposed to regulate water pollution. So there is, you know, that's their argument that there's duplication. But what the drinking water utilities and the general public and environmental groups have been saying is that there's times when you may want to have a rule that exceeds a federal guideline because there might be a particular situation in the river that needs to be addressed.
And I guess they might argue that more forcefully now that the EPA is actually rolling back some of these standards.
Yeah, that's definitely a point that environmental groups, as well as a fairly prominent commissioner, environmental attorney, Tom Fitzgerald, was arguing, was that these standards are needed because you never know exactly which direction the federal government's going to go. And so this is a way to strike some sort of regional consensus among the member states in terms of maintaining the Ohio River water quality or actually improving it.
And I believe the commissioner that you mentioned, Tom Fitzgerald, who's also the head of the nonprofit Kentucky Resources Council, has suggested that relaxing these standards would have implications for climate change. What's his concern there?
The argument with climate change, I guess, is that there's something like one coal-fired power plant for every 30 or 40 miles along the Ohio River. You know, they're facing potentially some newer, tougher EPA Clean Water Act standards, which are being held in abeyance from the EPA right now in the Trump administration. But the argument is these power plants, many of them are old, come close to outliving their designed lives, that this could keep them burning coal longer if you relax the rules. And then, of course, that means more carbon dioxide emissions, and which, you know, are linked to climate change.
Jim, I think it was last May, you reported that regional oversight over the river has helped to dramatically improve water quality in the river. And personally, I don't think of the Ohio as a body of water that I would want to swim in or drink from. But 5 million people do, and people do enjoy recreation on the river. Has the quality improved enough to change my perception?
I don't know about that, but I've lived in the area since the end of 1999. So I don't personally recall the Ohio River of the 1960s, but prior to the late 50s, there was no sewage treatment. And so you just had cities that were just treating their streams and creeks and the river itself like open sewers. So that's one issue. And there really wasn't any pollution controls, you know, on industry at that point. So people that I've talked to talk about how, you know, the river smelled like diesel fuel. The fish that you would eat would actually taste like diesel fuel or some kind of chemical. And the studies on terms of numbers and quantities of fish that were in aquatic life that were in the river, they've come back to a certain degree. And so, you know, I think that there were a lot of gains that were made once they put sewage treatment in and then the Clean Water Act came into effect. But there's still this problem with polluted runoff from cities and farms, and there's very little regulation of that. And so it kind of, I think the water quality is sort of, the experts tell me it's kind of hit a plateau. It still has residual pollution that's contained in the fish. There's a lot of mercury in the fish. There's other contaminants that are contained in the fish. So there's health advisories and you're not supposed to eat. There's limits on what they recommend that you can eat. But yet it's also as cities like Louisville in particular, and I think Cincinnati and some others, they're opening up their waterfronts, and it's becoming a front door instead of a back door. And they're very popular now for recreation. We have triathlons that are in Ironman competitions here in Louisville that have people swimming in the Ohio River. And there's bass fishing tournaments. So it's become, you know, a recreational place as well as, you know, a drinking water source. And of course, with drinking water utilities, they treat the drinking water. So they become very good at that. But yeah, I definitely think it's better than it was, but it's also still carries a pollution load. And, you know, there's times when you have to be careful if you went swimming in it with a cut in your leg because you might get an infection. And you have to maybe worry about if you were to swallow some water, you might get an infection. I think it's a lot of the sewage issues in particular would have a more immediate on the bacteria, would have more immediate impact on people's health.
So Orsanco, the commission that we mentioned, has so far endorsed a compromise proposal. Where does that stand now? What happens next?
Yeah, I think the earlier proposal, I've been led to believe that that's probably dead. They did not get enough votes to carry that through. They tentatively approved it last summer, and then last fall there was a meeting scheduled where they were going to approve it, and they didn't get enough votes to do that. And so now this compromise has come forward, and Orsanco now has to go through a regular public comment period, public input period. They've got a public hearing in Evansville, Indiana, April 4th. They've got one in Cincinnati, April 8th. And there's actually a webinar they're doing on their website, Orsanco's website, a webinar March 14th. And you can get details by going to their website. And then and they'll get that input, and then they have to analyze it and bring it back to their commission and decide kind of what to do next. So the question will be is, does this new proposal, does it give a number of the states also, because I was saying before that it turns out this is something that I think wasn't widely known until Tom Fitzgerald started looking into it as a commissioner, that a number of the states actually aren't following all of the Orsanco standards for various reasons. So the question is will this proposal satisfy the environmental community that wants to continue to have Orsanco have that authority? And will it also satisfy the states that want to be able to have flexibility in how they write their permits? And then, of course, you know, will it satisfy the industries that have been pushing for change?
Do you know how Kentucky ranks in terms of adhering to those standards?
Tom Fitzgerald has told me that they follow some, but not all. And the state has told me that the standards that they have are effectively the same or similar. And they're very detailed. I haven't had an opportunity to kind of go standard by standard to see, you know, exactly what it is. But as of 2015, there was a study that Orsanco did that found that there were 188 instances in which Orsanco had set a standard for a pollutant that neither a member state nor EPA had set a standard for. So they actually had like 188 standards that neither EPA or a state had. And there were some 252 instances in which Orsanco standards were at least 10% more stringent than those of a member state or the EPA. And one of those was arsenic, which, of course, can be found in waste from the burning of coal and is known to cause cancer.
James Bruckers covers the U.S. Southeast for Inside Climate News, and we thank you for joining us, Jim.
Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Coming up after the break, groups in eastern Kentucky who have had enough of the negative publicity and the reasons for it.
But what we're doing, and I think what you'll find when you come to eastern Kentucky these days, is there's a lot of forward thinking going on.
Jerry Roll of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky is joined by Laura Smith of the Appalachian Impact Fund, where entrepreneurialism is getting a lot of attention.
And we see that over and over. People are really systems thinkers in eastern Kentucky, so they're tackling multiple issues and multiple problems with really interesting solutions.
Plus, hemp and maple syrup. Stick with us. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Eastern Standard is made possible by One, the All-Tech Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Attendees are future thinkers who view technology as transformative opportunity for their business and lives. They share a belief in the boundless power of one idea to change everything. The 35th Annual Conference, 119, is May 19th through the 21st, 2019, in Lexington. Learn more at one.alltech.com.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. Learn more at hfkylawyers.com.
For years, generations really, Eastern Kentucky has been characterized and defined by others. In the weeks and months ahead, you're going to hear a different story about Appalachian Kentucky from the many who are making it their work and their missions to move the region into a post-coal rebirth. That begins now. Jerry Roll is here from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, where she's executive director. And we're also joined in the studio by Laura Smith of the Appalachian Impact Fund. These two nonprofits are out to improve quality of life and place in southeastern Kentucky. And we've invited Jerry and Laura here to talk to us about that mission. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Jerry and Laura.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And Jerry, let's turn to you first. The Foundation's website indicates that you follow a values-driven mission. Talk to us about those values.
Well, first of all, we're committed to place. Eastern Kentucky, our region, is one of the most beautiful places in the world and is my home. And it is where I've raised my children and my grandchildren. So our values are around community building. We value family and what family brings. And sometimes your family are the people who live in your home with you. And sometimes your family are your friends and your neighbors, the people you sit with in church. So we value family and the heritage that comes with that. We value our mountains and our region, our rivers, our lakes, our streams, the place where we live, the environment that we live in. We value our communities, the people that lead our community. We're committed to place, and I think that's the most important thing I can say about that, as we are a foundation that is based in Eastern Kentucky, for Eastern Kentucky. We're with Eastern Kentucky.
And Jerry, I know you live in the town of Busy, and what I know about the foundation is that you are very busy. In that it's kind of an umbrella organization for scores of little funds and so forth, right? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, we are. So a community foundation isn't like the big nationals we all hear about, Kellogg and Ford. A community foundation is just that. We create that base, that foundation in the community so that people, individuals or groups of people or nonprofits can have a place that serves as an anchor, a backbone, a way for folks to collaborate and work together on things that mean something to not just to them as individuals, but to the community. So right now we're hosting 144 different funds, and all of those funds represent something or some place in Appalachian Kentucky that is moving our region forward. So it could be a community like the Jackson County or the Leslie County Community Foundation Board, or it could be a fund for the whole region, like the Appalachian Impact Fund that Laura represents, or it can be something like a project or an initiative, the drone port, or the animal shelter. So we have a whole lot of things going on in Eastern Kentucky and Appalachian Kentucky, and we just serve as that backbone, that support, that even-handed facilitator that keeps all that stuff working together.
Okay. Laura Smith is also here with us, and Laura, you're with the Appalachian Impact Fund. What's that all about?
So we are, as Jerry just said, a component fund of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky. So we're one of 144 funds that are located at the Community Foundation. And we're focused on strategic grant making and also what's called impact investing. So we are the first and only place-based impact investment fund focused on Eastern Kentucky. And so we can do strategic grant making to organizations. We usually do what are called general operating support grants. And we can also make investments in unique and creative ways into projects and organizations. So our first impact investment we made was into a building in downtown Hazard, 420 Main Street, where the foundation now hosts their offices. And we host the offices of four other nonprofits. It's always growing.
growing
and changing every day as part of efforts to do downtown revitalization.
We're focused on, we have a priority geography of 5 counties in Eastern Kentucky. Those are Perry, Leslie, Harlan, Knott, and Letcher. And we invest in things like promising sectors, so local food and agriculture, arts and culture, tourism, and also into things that we call workforce empowerment initiatives. So those are things like rural daycare and childcare facilities, affordable and energy efficient housing. And with all of that, our mission is around a just and equitable economic transition in the coal fields. And we really value initiatives and organizations that are working to root local wealth, local ownership, and local asset development in our communities.
And I think from that, we can get a really good idea of your general criteria, mm-hmm. what you're going for. Mm-hmm. If we could get a little more granular and, mm-hmm, and sure, talk about what an individual who comes to you, they have an idea and, mm-hmm, and they want to sell you on it. What do you want to hear from them?
Well, we look for partners that are really rooted in their local communities, that are working towards solutions that can help diversify our economy, support local entrepreneurs, support the growth of different promising sectors that we're seeing in the region. So we're looking for partners that have strong outcomes, a track record, community buy-in, and have good ideas about what can move our region forward.
For each of you, question that each of you may want to answer individually, what sorts of issues are on your radar right now that you would like to tackle?
Well, that's one of the things it's interesting. Laura brought up the entrepreneurs and the outcomes. We have a whole lot of safety net programs, Tom, things that historically, whether it's drug recovery or food banks, shelter, emergency assistance, those are all good and right things that have to happen in every community, and especially in Eastern Kentucky, in places where there is a lot of need. But what we're doing, and I think what you'll find when you come to Eastern Kentucky these days, is there's a lot of forward thinking going on. And our focus has been around what's going to move our region forward, what's going to make our communities the kind of communities where interesting and new and creative things are going on that makes people want to stay. People want to come here. People want to live and raise their families. So we're looking at those things that make communities livable. That could be something like the local food sector. Everybody wants fresh local food now, and it doesn't get better than it gets in Eastern Kentucky. Childcare. We're looking to increase and build on high-quality, accessible, affordable childcare so people can work and know that their kids are being well cared for and nurtured and are going to be ready for school. We're looking at things like home ownership and building assets for families. So no matter what your job is or income is, let's find a way to make you a homeowner and build those assets. So we're really focused on those things that move our communities forward, that move our region forward, that make us the place where people want to live and raise a family. You know, we used to say in Eastern Kentucky, we want our kids to be able to come back home. I think everybody wants their kids to come home, but let's get real. It's the 21st century. Kids don't stay home in their backyard anymore. Kids want to go out and explore. What we'd really like to be is that place where other people's kids want to come and live and raise their families. So when we create those kinds of communities where there's arts and culture and history that we're proud of and that we can own and acknowledge and become a place where people want to live, those are the things we want to focus on.
And Laura, how about you?
Yeah, and I think to go along with that, in Eastern Kentucky, and I don't think this is unlike a lot of places in rural America, all of the issues are really interconnected in our community. So, for example, one of our grantee partners is the Kane Community Kitchen in Whitesburg, Kentucky. That's a commercial kitchen that was set up to serve the farmers involved with the local farmers market, but they're also creating entrepreneurial opportunities for people who want to do a value-added product. They have folks in there who are baking bread, who are creating jams and jellies and pickled products. And then they're also partnering with the local health clinic out of Whitesburg, working on a program called Pharmacy, which is actually a subscription vegetable program that's run through the farmers market. So, you know, there you see entrepreneurship, health, local food and ag. And we see that over and over. People are really systems thinkers in Eastern Kentucky. So they're tackling multiple issues and multiple problems with really interesting solutions.
We have a communications challenge at EKU, at WEKU, but really all of us in Eastern Kentucky who have some interest in moving the region forward. And that is how we balance attention to the region's problems, and there are many and some are very serious, against the very real need to build and sustain optimism and to promote a can-do spirit out there. How do we keep those things in balance and move forward at the same time?
You know, I think the key there is to stop thinking about problems and barriers and issues, looking at what we're dealing with as opportunities. So if what we want are all of our children to graduate from high school ready to succeed, whether that be in post-secondary or getting a job, then what are the conditions that we have in order for that to be true? And if that's not what we have, how do we make those conditions? And for me, for us, and what we're finding in our communities that we are working in and supporting is when you look at it in that frame of what's the opportunity here? We have suffered through a huge economic shift from the coal industry that carried a lot of our water to what are we going to do next? That's a blank slate. What's our opportunity? How do we tackle that? And when we engage everyone and think about these issues and barriers as opportunities looking for solutions, then it becomes a lot more interesting and exciting. And it's not to glaze over what's wrong, but simply to say we can get bogged down in what's wrong, or we can figure out how to move forward and do what's right. I think that energizes people. So we need to think about it in a different framework.
Do you all get the sense that we are finally at a point where we're done putting up with the stereotypes that have burdened us as a region for so, so long? Is there really a better story that can be told about Appalachian Kentucky?
There is absolutely a better story that can be told. There's a better story that is being told. I think our biggest problem is what are people listening to and hearing? Unfortunately, have some press. You know, I'll talk about everybody's friend J.D. Vance in Hillbilly Elegy. I don't begrudge J.D. his story. I'm sure he's a fine person. We've reached out. I would love to talk to him sometime. And that's his story. The issue, Tom, is not whether or not that's the story to tell. It's whether or not that's the only story people need to hear. So what I'm hoping for is we can get folks to listen to a different story. We all have stories, and every community out there across this nation has stories. What I would like to say and what I would like people to hear is that's not the only story. It's not even the biggest story. So let's get the better stories, the different stories out there, and hopefully people will begin to hear them. Because that's not our story. It's his story.
You want to add anything to that, Laura?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we are robbing ourselves of really good stories when we rely and use stereotypes as a crutch. And so, you know, if I believed everything that I read in the New York Times, I would think Eastern Kentucky is the gloomiest, you know, mm-hmm. darkest place in America. And it's just not. And when you get out and you meet people, you see what communities are doing, it's one of the most exciting places in America. I always tell folks when I get to travel around the country to talk to different funders that I work with some of the most creative and smartest people in America. And that's really the truth. So I think that there are so many better stories that could be told. And I don't mean that just in a Pollyanna-ish, you know, happy stories. Our stories are really complicated and complex, and they're rich. And I think that when we don't tell the full story, when we only hear the stereotype and the tropes that we all know and can repeat, we're robbing ourselves of a much richer experience.
Jerry Roll, Executive Director of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, and Laura Smith with the Appalachian Impact Fund, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And if you want to know more about the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, you'll find information about both organizations online at AppalachianKY, that's one word, AppalachianKY.org. Meanwhile, maple syrup. Here's Sydney Bowles from the Ohio Valley Resource.
Just a few years ago, Seth Long was tapping individual maple trees by hand and carrying gallon jugs of sap down the mountain to his house. Now, Long guns a mud-splattered all-terrain vehicle up steep switchbacks to a massive holding tank filled with sap. From here, the liquid runs through 900 feet of bright blue tubing to a brand new sugar shack.
When we were introduced to the tubing, we can do so much more because now I can get sap off of that tree up there way on that hilltop and never touch it until it's down at the evaporator.
Long and his wife, Cheryl, run Southdown Farm in Letcher County, Kentucky. Long is also the president of the Kentucky Maple Syrup Association, a group of maple producers trying to put the product on the map in the bluegrass state.
I always think about it like they did it then out of necessity because they had to. What if we did it today as an economic piece, as an economic driver?
Maple has always been big business in Ohio, but Kentucky and West Virginia aren't traditionally considered maple syrup country. Those states are at the southern end of where maple is a viable business. Still, early settlers in Kentucky and West Virginia tapped trees for personal use, and native communities made maple syrup before them. Now, both states are home to a small but growing number of producers who believe mechanized production can bring big profits and another reward that's a little harder to quantify.
The history of agriculture in Appalachia, a lot of it is just traditional small scale, what some might call subsistence farming or home gardening.
That's Kathleen Terry, Executive Director of Appalachian Sustainable Development. She helps small-scale farmers connect their wares to large-scale vendors. She says, for a generation or two, traditional farming fell by the wayside.
Now we're seeing people recognize, wow, we really lost something by stepping away from that. And in addition to losing the skills and the knowledge, they lost kind of a connection to their history.
Just over the state line, maple syrup producers have turned the niche commodity into a thriving cultural event. It's Maple Day in West Virginia. All across the state, maple producers are opening their sugar shacks to visitors. Here at Flanagan Family Maple, a young family gathers around a cotton candy machine. Local maple producer Rich Flanagan pours maple sugar into the machine, and the kids watch excitedly as hot sugar meets cold air and solidifies into a puffy, maple-tinted cloud. It smells amazing. The cotton candy sells for $4 a bag, and it's just one of the value-added products that makes maple syruping profitable. Mother and son Michelle Ball and Jacob Stiltner stopped by to check out the farm. Actually, they came here to learn. They tapped a few trees by their house this year.
How many gallons did we get?
I think right now we have about 20 gallons of sap, so we just always like try new things and stuff like that. Yeah, something different.
Just something to do.
Back outside, Greg Christian comes to buy some maple cotton candy. Christian is 31, and he runs Tom's Creek Family Farms. He says more than 100 people have come to his Maple Day event, a pancake breakfast, and he's completely sold out of Rich Flanagan's maple cotton candy. I asked him why he thinks the pancake breakfasts are so popular.
Labor and the sugar. And a lot of people like tradition.
Christian says he's one of a handful of young West Virginians he knows who saw the demise of a coal economy and are looking to agriculture as a more sustainable alternative. But the best part of running his farm, Christian says, is sharing the experience with his daughter. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Sydney Bowles in Pritchard, West Virginia.
Pancake robot, come and get them while they're hot.
The pancake robot is coming to town. He's mixing up the batter and he's laying it down. Buttermilk, blueberry, chocolate chip. 50 million pancakes, he's gonna flip. All you can eat.
Coming up in a moment, Annie Rouse on what the future holds for Kentucky hemp.
Being able to utilize hemp fiber within bioplastics and within animal bedding and within building materials and automotive components and even textiles, that's a massive market opportunity, especially as the world economy shifts more into these natural fibers and looking more into the environmental impact of, you know, petroleum-based plastics versus plant-based plastics.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Eastern Standard is made possible by One, the Alltech Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Attendees are future thinkers who view technology as a transformative opportunity for their businesses and lives. They share a belief in the boundless power of just one idea to change everything. The 35th Annual Conference, 119, is May 19th through 21st, 2019, in Lexington. Learn more at one.alltech.com.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. Learn more at hfkylawyers.com. Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
Well, to say that hemp is hot in Kentucky is an understatement. Hemp processors across the state reported almost $58 million in gross product sales last year, compared to about $17 million in 2017. And after the passage and signing of the Farm Bill late in 2018, it's Katie bar the door. 50,000 acres are approved for growing hemp this year, and that's more than three times compared to last year. And according to State Agriculture Commissioner Ryan Quarles, hemp will be grown in as many as 100 of the state's 120 counties this year. One product, CBD, or hemp oil, is suddenly huge, touted as an alternative treatment for everything from anxiety and depression to inflammation and pain. Annie Rouse is an early arriver in the CBD industry. Nature's Hemp Oil, which is produced by the company that she co-founded recently, became one of only 13 hemp companies certified by the industry group, the U.S. Hemp Authority. Annie is an adventurous, world-traveling native Kentuckian entrepreneur, a Fulbright scholar, a master in international environmental policy and business administration, a producer, and an investigative journalist. And we're pleased to have you here, Annie.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And let's start with that certification, the certified seal awarded to your CBD brand by the U.S. Hemp Authority. What is that organization, first of all?
Yeah, so the U.S. Hemp Authority is a new self-regulatory organization. The organization was formed with the understanding that as an industry, we really needed to put a step forward and start to regulate the players in the industry, whether it's the farmers, the processors, the manufacturers, or the distributors that are selling the finished products. So there's already some movement to create standards in the industry, like with ASTM and an international basis, but that's really going to take several years to get into mainstream and get approved. It's also created for cannabis as a whole plant, as opposed to specifically to hemp. So the authority took steps forward to really start to create this initiative so that when hemp passed more recently with the 2018 Farm Bill, we would be able to have something intact to be able to provide to the USDA, to the FDA, to say, hey, we're taking positive steps forward to make sure that this is safe and this is legal.
So does this authority offer training programs to processors and to growers?
Yes. So the U.S. Hemp Authority has partnered with the Hemp Industries Association, of which I'm on the board of directors. And the Hemp Industries Association offers different training programs. They're really meant for farmers and processors who are not familiar with good agricultural practices and good manufacturing practices. The industry is so new that there are a lot of very good players in it that know these kinds of protocols and practices that you should have in place. But the industry is also bringing on a lot of new people that maybe have never farmed before or never had a finished product or processed anything before. So they really need to understand what procedures and standard operating procedures that they need to have in place in order to make something safe.
Does getting that certificate, certification by the U.S. Hemp Authority, does that require inspections of your operations?
Yes. So the U.S. Hemp Authority is very similar to like USDA Organic. They actually license the seal. However, the on-site audits are performed by a third-party auditing company, very similar to how USDA Organic operates. And so the audits are in-person audits on an annual basis. And the auditing company is run by a program called Where Food Comes From, and their certification body is called Validus. And they actually come out to the facility or to the farm, and they go through a check sheet that answers certain questions as in terms of your protocols that you have in place.
Okay, let's say I'm a consumer. I'm interested in CBD oil, and I want to know what's in it. And I don't know where to turn. The FDA is currently not regulating the oil, correct? So I'm just wondering, do you think it be subject to third party, if not regulation, at least clinical trials or human testing and some sort of labeling so that you can know what the contents are?
Yeah, definitely. And in some aspects, the industry has taken steps to do this. Indiana, for instance, has the most strict labeling regulations for CBD, hemp-derived CBD products. They actually require you to have a QR code on your bottle that links to lab results. And then the U.S. Hemp Authority seal requires you to have lab testing for cannabinoids and different contaminants like heavy metals, pesticides, residual solvents, microbiologics. And so there's definitely a progression to move into that as a whole industry. And you'll find that most of the big players in the market are doing this. They're very transparent in what is in their bottle. You know, they want you to be educated and to have that information right in front of you. Another company that I founded called Anavi Market, A-N-A-V-I-I Market, we actually do a third-party verification as well. So we look to companies now that have that U.S. Hemp Authority seal, but then we also have the brands go through a certification or application as well so that we can take a look at their different lab tests and what their procedures are so that they're fully vetted. We also personally test them ourselves to make sure they work. And then we'll send them off to labs as well. So commonly, some of the major labs on the market are Eurofins Diagnostics and ProVerde. And Eurofins is an international lab. They're a huge company. ProVerde is very specific to cannabis. And both of those are pretty solid labs. They, you know, have good standards in place. However, you know, the industry, because it's been regulated for the past 80 years, there hasn't really been a way to create these standards for analytical testing. So that's something that the industry is really having to wrap their heads around. And Eurofins is one of the labs that's really leading the way on creating those standards.
So this expected imperative now to test is something to consider if you're going to invest in hemp processing. I mean, that can't be inexpensive.
Oh, yeah. It's very expensive. And, you know, the industry is – it's not as easy as what people might think it is to get into it, especially with the consumable products, because there is a safety concern there. CBD is considered safe as a compound in general within the body. But, you know, you asked earlier about clinical trials. There's still a lot we don't know about cannabinoids and how they're interacting with certain medications and things in that regard that really need to be more fully vetted. You know, in general, the World Health Organization has specified that, hey, we've looked at all this reviewed clinical and non-clinical data, and we believe that it is safe. But there is still a lot to know in terms of how much to take for certain things. Of course, as an industry, we cannot make medical claims, unlike GW Pharmaceuticals, who has the FDA-approved drug Epidiolex that has been clinically approved and tested for epilepsy. So they can say, yes, you can use this for epilepsy, but the industry, the hemp industry, cannot say that. There's a lot of weird nuances and that need to be learned. And of course, a lot of education that needs to be made, especially with educating pharmacies and educating doctors. Every time that I see a doctor, I immediately ask them, what do you think about CBD? And normally every doctor says the same thing. Well, we know it has medical benefit for epilepsy. We believe that there is positive benefit for things like anxiety and inflammation, but there's not any clinical data that can prove that.
Well, what do you think will become the dominant applications of hemp and hemp byproducts, for that matter?
That's a tough question because the industry, we've been such a proponent of CBD, 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 drilling that into people. But in that regard, it's really not just CBD. It's cannabinoids across the board. There's 100 other cannabinoids within this plant that we're just scratching the surface on, alongside of terpenes and other essential amino acids and vital nutrients, not just in the cannabinoids, but also within the seed. And the grain has a huge market opportunity. Right now, we use a lot of soy in pretty much everything that we eat, particularly soy protein isolate. It's very high in omega-6, which creates a lot of inflammation, whereas hemp seed, and now there's a hemp protein isolate that'll likely be coming to market soon. Hemp protein has a much better fatty acid profile. So it's more balanced. It's actually the most perfect, balanced, natural protein that's around. And it has a lot more omega-3 than omega-6, so it balances some of that the proteins that may cause inflammation. So that's a huge market opportunity. But in order for both of those to truly succeed and become commoditized, we really need the fiber industry to take off. And it already is in very high demand, and there's not enough supply to actually push into the markets because everyone's so focused on CBD and you really can't use the fiber in the same applications. So I mean, I think in the long term, being able to utilize hemp fiber within bioplastics and within animal bedding and within building materials and automotive components and even textiles, that's a massive market opportunity, especially as the world economy shifts more into these natural fibers and looking more into the environmental impact of, you know, petroleum-based plastics versus plant-based plastics.
As I mentioned in the opening, the acreage that has been approved for planting this year is triple last year. So there's a lot of that going on. And also mentioned that gross product sales by Kentucky hemp processors tripled between 2017 and 2018. Can that level of growth be sustained, do you think, or do you think it'll eventually hit a plateau?
In general, it's got to hit a plateau at some point. But when we hit that plateau, it'll be hard to say. I think with something like CBD, the market is definitely becoming flooded, especially with the ability now to import CBD a little bit more easily. And that's going to definitely bottom out prices if you can import cannabinoids for much cheaper from China or from Africa, I've recently read. That will definitely sink prices, but it'll be the end consumer. Do they want Kentucky grown? Do they want U.S. grown? What are they actually demanding? Do they actually care if it's U.S. grown or not? But I've heard that only 2-5% of the U.S. population even knows what CBD is. So obviously there's still tremendous growth opportunity there. The food, apparently it's only penetrated 1-2% of the population. So still a tremendous growth opportunity there. So I don't think it'll be plateauing anytime soon. However, I do see that a price, at least within the CBD range, will definitely start to drop as economies of scale really kick in. And it's a fluctuating market at this point, whereas grain and fiber are pretty stable because Canada and Europe have been growing it and utilizing it for so long. But the U.S. industry has really been where the cannabinoid market has exploded.
I also mentioned in the opening that you are a producer, and I know that you produce a podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, so it is a series podcast called Anslinger, The Untold Cannabis Conspiracy, and it's a combination of narration and interviews with experts at the topic at hand. So I've actually dived in the last 10 years, I've traveled all around the U.S., going to different government archives, and have tried to unfold why cannabis became prohibited under Commissioner Harry Anslinger, who was chief of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics from 1930 to 1962. So he created virtually every drug enforcement strategy that exists today. And and, you know, with cannabis being one of the major ones. And obviously we're living in a world now where people are really starting to question drug policies with the opioid epidemic and cannabis, of course. And so it's a very timely piece, and it really looks at Big Pharma's role in cannabis prohibition, whereas a lot of, you know, the quote unquote cannabis conspiracy in the past looks more at the fiber industry and the paper industry and the plastics industry. This really dives more into what was the pharmaceutical industry doing within this time frame, and why is it potentially prohibited today and now kind of coming out of this fold, now, you know, moving more into that pharmaceutical light.
So it's serialized? Are there a number of episodes?
Yeah. So right now there's 9 episodes that have been launched. You can find it on Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, thinkhempythoughts.com. And I would definitely recommend starting it at season 1, episode 1, because it gives you light into Harry Anslinger as an individual and then takes you through time. And right now I'm in about 1935 in the series. So
and search on Annie Rouse.
Yeah, you could probably search Annie Rouse on iTunes or you know, your podcast app, or Anslinger, A-N-S-L-I-N-G-E-R, and it should populate.
Okay, and that is Annie, R-O-U-S-E?
Yes.
Annie Rouse, co-founder of Nature's Hemp Oil. Thanks so much, Annie.
Yeah, thank you.
With us on next week's edition of Eastern Standard, imagining and growing a new economy in Eastern Kentucky.
The big, most important takeaway about a creative economy for Eastern Kentucky is that we're talking about very pragmatic steps we can take to help create jobs and really boost the economy. You know, this is not something that is about anything that's art as luxury or, you know, painting for feelings. This is truly about creating jobs.
Sky Marietta, Arts Extension Associate with Community and Economic Development of Kentucky, based at UK. Sky and her husband, Jeff Marietta, are practicing what they preach, and there's evidence of it on Main Street in Corbin and coming soon to another Eastern Kentucky town. You'll hear all about it. And WEKU's Sherry Lawson on award-winning writer and poet Pauletta Hansel, who recently paid a visit to the place where she first realized that she had these talents, her Breathitt County home of Jackson. Before we go, thank you to everybody who renewed their membership during last week's Spring Pledge Drive or got involved for the first time in our mission here at WEKU, and that is in-depth coverage of the Bluegrass and Appalachian regions of Kentucky. A commitment to lifelong learning and to intellectual curiosity are just two of the shared values that we have in common with our entire radio community here at WEKU. That's right, public radio is for smart people, and really smart people chip in to keep it alive. There's no wall between our audience and our content. We're in this community, and we're going down this path together. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is a broadcast service of Eastern Kentucky University, produced in the Lexington studios of Dynamics Productions, with the support of 1, the Alltech Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. Information about Eastern Standard content partnerships can be found online at esweku.com. Now you can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on the WEKU mobile app, available for Apple and Android devices. Eastern Standard is also available as a podcast. You'll find us on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We'd like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.